250 years ago, the then British colonialists and about to become American citizens declared in their Declaration of Independence that the foundation of their new republic would be life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We can all subscribe to that, but what are the origins of happiness? Is it, as Aristotle argued, to use whatever gifts the gods have given us to make the world a little bit better? And the rest, from having shelter, food, family, and warmth, while important, are subordinate to pursuing your purpose? Or was Aristotle wrong? And there are less lofty ways to reach that goal. Sharing a meal together, living in a genuine community, giving and receiving gifts freely. We need to know the answers. Unhappy people are less likely to live longer, more likely to suffer debilitating mental illness, don't vote, and to be swayed by more extreme political parties, if they do vote. Those connections are no longer anecdotes. They are measurable, comparable, and increasingly impossible for policymakers to ignore. Our guest today is Jan Emanuel Deneve, Professor of Economics and Behavioural Science at the University of Oxford and Director of the Wellbeing Research Centre located at Harris Magister College, where he serves as Vice Principal. As a leading voice in the science of happiness and well-being, he's the man to help navigate our way through the data and the arguments. Jan's work brings rigorous data and empirical methods to questions once thought to be too subjective to measure. He has advised governments and international organizations on how to put well-being at the heart of public policy. Are we at last at the point of making the Declaration of Independence live? This year's World Happiness Report, published by the Wellbeing Research Centre at the University of Oxford, is out now. And behind that report is Jan and his colleague, including Richard Layard, who we've had previously on this podcast. So welcome to the We Society. Talk about happiness in the round. When I was talking about Aristotle and then less lofty ways of achieving happiness, what were your reactions to that part of the introduction?
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for having me on this wonderful show, and I hope it'll be exciting. I'm sure it will be, at least for the two of us, and hopefully for many others listening in. The pursuit of happiness, and Aristotle, you meant. Aristotle thought of it quite differently from the way we might measure it now. He thought of it more virtue-based, which is what you were hinting at, the purpose of life and in purpose of others. So there's more of an other-regarding element within it. Nowadays, we would consider measurements of the good life a bit more mundane to some extent. We would simply ask you, Will, on a scale from 0 to 10, how satisfied are you with your life these days? And the argument we'd make within the science of well-being is that Aristotle's eudaimonic view of the good life, which is more virtue-based, feeds into that. So if you're doing lots of good things for others, that should feed positively into your life satisfaction. That's how Richard Layard, myself, and others would typically view it at this point in time.
Very, very interesting. So let's kind of move on to the substance of what you do. I mean, you are a social scientist who consecrates his time and intellectual effort getting under the skin of well-being and what makes us happy. In a few crisp sentences, tell me and our listeners the answer to that question.
What is happiness?
Yeah.
You know what? After all, for me, in my case, about a decade and a half of studying well-being and happiness, in a way, we've always deviated the question. We leave that to the philosophers who've been breaking their heads on this particular question of what is the good life for the past 2,000 plus years since Aristotle. Yeah. And in a way, us, the economists and the psychologists about 20, 30 years ago, we bypassed all of this by going straight to subjective well-being and asking you the question, Will, how happy are you? No matter what that might be based upon. So we, in a way, are agnostic about what drives well-being. We listen to people bottom up and we ask them, are they happy? Whatever makes them happy. And then we work from that point and we reverse engineer to see, as science, social scientists, empirical scientists, to see what actually explains variation in people's responses. And needless to say, lo and behold, stuff like a decent amount of purchasing power, income, a good job, having a rich social life, access to nature and the environment, et cetera, matter a great deal. Obviously, health, physical and mental as well. It's not just income and GDP per capita that will explain individual or population well-being. We'll find other things like healthy life expectancy, duh. But also our social lives, our social capital. Do we trust other people? Something as mundane as the number of lunches and dinners we share with other people throughout the week turn out to be wonderful predictors of our life satisfaction and differences between individuals on that front. And so in a way, by reverse engineering from not defining it, just measuring it, it allows us also to provide novelty and insight that people wouldn't have typically thought of.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the society of friends and laughter are much more important than anything else. kind of, yeah. Yes. But you said laughing.
But joking aside, I mean, and it's very serious. When I came into this world of science of well-being through studying the importance of work, and you think if you lose your job, well, you've lost your pay. That would help explain the reduction in one's well-being. But the fact of the matter is that when people are made redundant and they lose their job, only less than half of the drop in well-being is explained by the drop in pay. More than half is explained by the loss of your social social ties, the loss of social identity, the loss of a routine, etc. You see the importance of the social aspects of our lives in driving quality of life.
We're social animals. We're human beings. We're social animals. Back to Aristotle. Yeah. Are the British happy?
Such a good question. The average life satisfaction in Britain is, to be very precise, 6.7-ish. So you're always sort of bumping.
And 10 is good and 1 is bad.
Zero is very bad and 10 is very good. Now, if you want to put a bit of a context around this, the happiest country in the world, and it still is this year in the latest version of the World Happiness Report, is Finland, perhaps surprisingly. But don't forget, the way we're measuring this is through, are people satisfied with their lives? It's more a sense of contentment than sort of joy, happy-go-lucky, fluffy happiness. Their average life satisfaction from a random sample of a representative sample sampled around the country in Finland is closer to 8. So they're more like 7.8 out of 10, whereas the Brits are more like 6.7, 6.8. Now, at the very bottom, and just think about this for a second, go in Afghanistan, the Gallup organization who does the polling for us on this front, they will sample a representative group of Afghanis, and the average response to the life satisfaction question is 1.2. So imagine that. So just for empirical minded folk, to get an average of 1.2 out of 10, for everyone, if there's anyone out there who says a 3 or a 4 or a 5, you already need a whole bunch of zeros just to bring it back to 1.2. So people in Afghanistan are darn aware of the fact that their lives are poor and the quality of life miserable, and they don't hide it from us.
I don't think that many people know that. That was news to me. I mean, I would have guessed that happiness in Afghanistan would be low. I mean, the Taliban, the treatment of women, I can't imagine a woman in Afghanistan saying...
And we picked this up...
0 to 1, I would have thought, yeah.
Exactly. We picked this up in the data, and you're quite right. Since the introduction of the Taliban or the Taliban coming back, we've seen a precipitous drop. I think they started... When we started the World Happiness Report, thanks to the Gallup World Poll, which was in about 2009, 2010, they were still around sort of 4 out of 10, 3.5 out of 10, and that's been halved the quality of life in the space that we've been studying and these trends in well-being. So they're by a long mile the worst off people, according to their own subjective well-being.
Is that true across most Islamic countries, actually, that actually the happiness scores are poor?
No. And it's a good question. If you look at even Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, they rank around place 21st, 22nd.
Which, above Britain, in fact.
Above Britain. You're quite right. So Britain, in the last report, was a position 23 or 24. It's now dropped to, I think, 26th or 27th place, which sits behind the UAE and Saudi.
How big are these samples?
They're representative samples of 1,000 people that are being...
Right, so people who do polls reckon 1,000 is about what... Yeah,
exactly.
You get answers which are robust that way.
A thousand, yeah.
Now, Professor Philippe Aguillon won the Nobel Prize for Economics this year. He's in the We Society podcast series, and he also cites Finland. He thought they've got the best kind of combination of creative destruction and a social underpinning of the fallout of that. And he particularly identified the Finnish education system, which is, in his view, amongst the best in the world. When I say that to you, you're nodding. You're saying, those are things which you could imagine would explain this persistence of Finland as number one in the world.
I'm nodding and I've got, honestly, goosebumps, because to have a Nobel Prize winner essentially sort of endorse or hint at the same outcome, which we've come at from a single item question in the World Happiness Report with the likes of Finland and the other Nordic and Scandinavian countries coming out on top, is obviously pleasing to hear. I would agree, and I think it complements what we typically pick up on. So he looks at disruptive innovation and the economics and the fallout, as you just mentioned.
What we, and the education system.
And the education system, all of which I think underpins and helps explain why Finland does so well. Again, truth be told, Denmark is a close second.
Yep.
And we then also have the likes of Norway and Iceland, Switzerland, the Netherlands up there in the top 10 as well. Finland scores particularly well on not just having wealth, but having it properly redistributed. So it's a very equal society.
Yeah,
it's literally right. Society, a
yeah.
rising tide lifting Agnew all boats.
Professor Agnew points to that, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's one thing. The second thing is very great health, healthy life expectancy. But then something that really stands out with them is the social support. So if you ask questions around, do you trust others? Do you trust the institutions? Do you have friends to rely on in case of trouble? So these kind of items that try and gauge the level of social capital, as Bob Putnam would have called it, but sort of trust
Robert
and belonging.
Putnam, the great
sociologist. Yeah. And so they do particularly well on that. But so do the other Nordic and Scandinavian countries. What I think sets Finland apart, maybe beyond what Aguillon is suggesting around how they manage disruptive innovation, is their very close connection to nature, even more so than the other Nordic and Scandinavian.
It's a country of thousands of lakes.
Thousands. And they all seem to have their cabin on one of these lakes.
I know.
partially because they have lots of space. There are quite a few of them. But so they do a lot of things right, despite the not-so-great weather, which they seem to live with appropriately. Truth be told, when the Finns see our report and they come out on top, they're always a bit skeptical. They say, ha, 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 we're not necessarily the happiest people. So what is this all about? But then we typically have the New York Times sending a journalist to Finland. They always start by like, why would Finland be the happiest country in the world? And then it starts with sort of a healthy skepticism. And by the end of this investigative journalist piece, you understand, because these are elderly people, for example, the elderly within Finland, connect, do saunas together, play together, are actively engaged. The educational system that you already referred to is very strong. The healthcare system is very strong. People have healthy aspirations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Nothing like having a sauna with someone to kind of...
And then the sauna is really quite
happy,
sacred.
And then go in the pool.
So there's a lot going there for them that they leverage. And truth be told, whatever it is, it seems to work, because life satisfaction is indeed the highest for them.
Let's discuss Britain.
Yes.
I mean, there we are. We were 23 last year. We're now, what, 26, 27?
26, 27.
We're going down.
Yes.
Everybody listening to this will have their own explanations for that. But what are yours? You work with the data.
So the truth be told, the data going down in the ranking, part because, yes, there's a gradual decline in life satisfaction. So moving from 6.8 to 6.7 and in that direction. But you're going down in the rankings also because others are going up. And the ones that are going up are the Central and Eastern European countries have moved quite a bit. So the likes of Slovenia, Lithuania have actually seen quite positive increases over the past decade. So they've literally moved a whole point in the last decade, so from 6 to 7. And that partially explains the drop of Britain. But to your point, we see a gradual decline. So it's not like a massive decline. Life satisfaction doesn't move that swiftly, which we also see in other parts of the Western world, and particularly North America, New Zealand, Australia. And if you're asking for explanations, I would straight away point in the direction of youth. If you slice and dice it by generations, you don't see the baby boomers reducing their life satisfaction. You do see youth dropping in well-being. And I have the numbers on mine for the United States. If you were to look at the baby boomers in the United States, they'd be top 10 in the world. If you look at the below 25s, they wouldn't even make the top 60. In the world. And Britain isn't quite that extreme, but there's definitely something there too. And so youth in the West, and especially the English-speaking West, are the ones driving down the average, and that necessitates an urgent look. And that's actually been the focus of this year's report.
And it's not just student debt. It's not just the paucity of jobs. It's also spending hours daily scrolling, endlessly doom-scrolling, and kind of on their iPhones that is making them unhappy, particularly young women.
Yes.
Are you picking that up in the data?
We are, but this requires a lot more contextualizing. The first thing to note is there's a lot going on for youth. It isn't just social media that is to blame. It's the affordability, it's the housing crisis, they can't get onto the housing ladder, and much else. But social media does play a role, especially for those who are indeed doom-scrolling up to 5, 6, 7 hours plus a day, in addition to everything else that's happening on the internet, a day. And that's particularly so for young women. and particularly so in the English Western world. And so we see a large effect of a whole point plus drop in life satisfaction. If we simply split out those that are using social media problematically, which we define as 5 hours plus, versus those that use it, not use it, or especially what we find is to be slightly, possibly the optimal, 1 hour or less.
I now can't remember where I read it, but the man who invented the algorithm that made scrolling endless regrets it very much, reinforcing that by saying, don't abandon social media altogether. Just use it in a controlled way and self-discipline yourself to use it for optimally an hour, you're saying.
But Will, the problem there is, do we have the self-discipline to do so? Because you have an army of the smartest engineers forcing these algorithms to try and nudge us in the direction of doom scrolling. The question that I'm personally struggling with is, yes, we found that the optimal use of well-being is a positive engagement for an hour or less. That seems to be associated with the highest levels of life satisfaction, whereas a lot too much of it is problematic and drops life satisfaction. No usage today, despite having access to it, but consciously not using it today, seems to be slightly less good for life satisfaction than using an hour or less. But the question is, policy-wise, what can we do to essentially reduce the problematic social media use, which is a lot of people are using it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 plus hours a day. A big part of the young population is.
And reading is falling away.
How can we work with the social media companies to essentially put guardrails in place, stop the doom scrolling, nudge people off of social media, none of this is they're incentivized to do, these companies, needless to say. And the strongest policy is the one, obviously, that our colleagues Jonathan Haidt and Zach Rauch and others are suggesting, which is a complete ban on social media for below 16-year-olds, which is obviously a radical extreme measure. And so we're sort of struck in the World Happiness Report about, okay.
Now, Jonathan Haidt has written this book on the anxious generation.
Runaway bestseller. It resonated with a lot of people, especially the baby boomer parents or grandparents, as it turns out. And he's been incredibly successful and is the person essentially having inspired the ban in Australia that went into play early December last year. I think we should all wait and see, hopefully soon, preliminary results will come out of what the actual impact is of this quite extreme ban.
It was mid-December. It's, you know, we're now in the spring, so it's 3 months, 4 months. Hardly time to make an accurate reading, is it?
No, but there's some first indications of what's happening. So to what extent has the ban been effective, ineffectively?
Apparently quite effective.
Quite effective. And then at the same time, there's also lots of instances of young people trying to get around it by faking being older than 16. There's also a move away from the likes of TikTok and Instagram onto sort of secondary platforms that do more or less the same. And then there's also hints of the fact that a lot of that time is now moving into these AI bots, so chatting with ChatGPT rather than with actual human beings. We have to wait and see, as you say,
What do you make of people who claim that their AI bot is their closest friend?
It is extraordinary. And I would actually, the notion of AI coaching, engaging with AI bots, if it doesn't come at the expense of human to human, if it's in addition to, or coaching or therapy would not have been available unless it was given through AI, because it's way more cost effective, then I am actually in favor of it. How much can an organization afford to provide resources to have an individual coach for everybody in the organization? Answer, no. It might do it for the top layer, the top 100 executives, for example. But now, thanks to AI bots, we can suggest it may not be the same caliber or quality as a human to human, but at least there could be approaches made to try and have AI coaches rolled out across the organization, because it's now feasible from an economic perspective, which it wasn't before. So I do see big advantages. I mean, AI comes with a lot of promise, but obviously a lot of risks as well. So the real risk is where it cannibalizes the human to human. So if instead of getting married to your partner, you so engage with your AI counterpart that you essentially forgo actual interactions with other human beings, that would be devastating. But where it's in addition to, I think it's probably positive.
Just a brief pause in the conversation to tell you a bit about the Academy of Social Sciences, which is the organization behind the We Society podcast. I'm Will Hutton, the president of the Academy of Social Sciences. We're a national body for academics, practitioners, and learned societies in the social sciences. we champion the vital role of social science in our society, from education to government and business. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. Hearing you talk and expound, you do blend a kind of philosophy of life, stressing the importance of social interaction, the humanity of the society of others. But I mean, you've actually been advising the Treasury, haven't you? This isn't just, you know, two men in a studio talking about happiness in a broad brush way. You're actually concretely saying to the British government, come on, spend pounds, shillings and pence in these areas and not these areas.
You're quite right. It's mostly my colleagues at the London School of Economics, Richard Layard, Christian Crackle, who are spending a lot of their days interacting with the Cabinet Office, the UK Treasury. I find the Treasury to be very open and interested in this, and the Cabinet Office. And across the years, and across parties, and across governments to date, which is really exciting. Lest we forget, it's the Office for National Statistics and the Cabinet Office that in the David Cameron years, 2012-ish, they actually started measuring, and they put a little bit of money aside to ask the ONS, can you integrate in the population survey a question around how satisfied Brits are with their lives these days? And that's been the source of much
well-being
research.
Was meant it was going to be a kind of... David Cameron wanted his government to be judged by the degree to which it promoted or did not promote well-being. And for a year or two, it went quite well, but it's fallen beside the wayside a bit, hasn't it?
Yes and no. Politically, perhaps, but the administration, the UK Civil Service, has continued to show interest in this. Ah. And the UK Civil Service is being schooled on the notions of how to apply well-bees and cost-effectiveness.
So, a couple of years back, I was invited to a kind of a presentation on this, and I nearly fell off my chair when the kind of head of public expenditure in the Treasury was saying, you know, I take this, how seriously I take this. And I thought, you know, you guys are making inroads here, but I'm not sure it translates into
not yet. And so one way that we're trying to make inroads more with the politicians, last year, we now serve as the secretariat for the all-party parliamentary group on well-being economics.
An all-party parliamentary group on well-being economics.
Exactly. And there's
there's
20-plus MPs who signed up to it, and it's really a laudable effort to try and bring well-being science to the heart of policymaking.
But it says things like, you get more well-being from having a kind of frequent bus service that kind of doesn't go all the way into the center of a town but connects the suburbs up. That will promote much more well-being than building a high-speed rail connection from Edinburgh to London. I mean, that's the kind of thing you come up with, isn't it?
It's a good point. And yes, and Richard Layard is well known to have said we should invest a lot more into social infrastructure. And you're quite right. If you go to the traditional recipe that tends to drive policy, it's meant GDP and growth for the sake of growth, really. And then that prioritizes material infrastructure projects. Build, build, build. Anything that's sort of shovel ready, as I say, and these kind of things. But the extent to which those projects actually lead to increases in the well-being of the population is a different question. And the things that matter a lot more than people expect, like our social lives, local communities, bridge clubs, supporting football teams and clubs in local communities, that's the social infrastructure that gets underinvested.
What levers would you pull now, low-lying fruit, that actually you and your team kind of advocate the British government pulls the levers on to promote well-being and happiness?
Oh, there's so much. So mental health, you mentioned, is a big one. And a lot more resources could go in that direction. Social infrastructure, so community lives.
What do you mean when you say social infrastructure, community lives? I don't understand.
Essentially, I'm literally thinking, so I live out in the Oxford countryside, and there's a lot of relatively poor villages around us with little football clubs. And that's what keeps communities together and social lives. And yet I see there's so very little support for these things that generate a social tissue between people all over Britain. It doesn't add to GDP, but it makes a massive difference to people's quality of lives.
People are kind of desperate about the closure of local post offices, local
pubs. For example. And all of that makes a lot of sense from an effectiveness, scale economy type approach, but it doesn't make much sense from a well-being perspective. And then there's also jobs. Employment, youth unemployment is rising for people coming out of universities, affordability of younger generations. So frankly, Will, my main concern is a drop in youth well-being, especially here and in the larger Western English-speaking world. And you can tell it's social media essentially preying on vulnerable people if they go off doom scrolling. The affordability crisis, schooling going up, school fees going up again, despite the university system not necessarily preparing people for the future of work.
Not everyone's paying for education. I mean, the public education system is free.
I'm thinking higher education. I'm referring to it.
Yeah. It's good that we're broadening the conversation out. I mean, I think we've circled around a bit, and I think we should kind of home in on it rather more before we wind this conversation up. And that's actually what happens at work. I mean, now there's a lot of evidence that actually people have been giving less task discretion at work, more monitoring. One of the impacts of AI is that people can actually see what you're doing on your laptop or your PC. They can judge if you're on a Zoom call to what extent you're being attentive or not, or doing something else. The micromanaging of people's behavior is becoming kind of, I'm just thinking about what you're picking up about the workplace and how one could put that on the agenda more than we have.
Thank you for raising this. Well, this is right up my alley and what I'm doing right now. So I really research on workplace well-being, and I'm incredibly worried about this. And I think we're at a crossroads. And you're familiar with the Robert Frost poem, Two Roads Diverged.
Yep.
And you know, I took the road less traveled and it made all the difference. I'm afraid to say that what I'm seeing is that most companies, say 9 out of 10, in the road of how to use AI, most of them are adopting it in sort of an automation monitoring type way rather than a human augmentation way. I'm really worried about this because it means essentially that not only do we have the issues that you described around monitoring and controlling, but that we're also looking to essentially slash headcounts. Despite productivity gains, the knee-jerk reaction of senior leaders and boards is typically, oh, so we've become 20% more productive. Oh, you've got 5 more hours in a day. Maybe we can reduce teams of 10 to teams of 8 as a result. Or we can give you a bit more of the same tasks, and perhaps that of your neighbor who we no longer need to renew his contract. And it touches the young people first. There's what we call a seniority bias, which is that senior leaders and senior folk in organizations are spared this ordeal, but it's junior, mostly white collar in this case, that are either no longer being renewed, not hired in the first place, or being laid off. And then again, it's going to lead to a social massacre. I mean, it's going to be very, very difficult in the years to come. And I think we'll start picking it up clearly now. There's also much less jobs available now for junior white collars, about a third less jobs on the job aggregation sites since the introduction of ChatGPT for younger white collar folk. So I think there's a choice.
Hold on, just stop there, Jan. I mean, that's a big number. Hold on, and I've not seen that foregrounded elsewhere. I mean, you're saying that for young people leaving university,
so 25 years of age, around that age,
that there's a third less jobs available.
Yes.
In the spring of 2026 than there were compared
about two or three years ago.
That's a devastating change.
It is. And you're saying
it's AI that's driven that?
Partially.
And where does that data come from?
Indeed, which is the world's largest job search platform, has most jobs ads available. And they're essentially seeing a huge drop in the job ads for junior white collars. And they see that drop essentially is sort of picking up since about ChatGPT's introduction. And it's mostly because these companies are anticipating the gains from productivity. They haven't actually seen them in many cases, but they're on hold and prefer not to invest in junior talent on the expectation that they may not need to be hired. In 2025, Will, it was no hiring, no firing. I think 2026, it's not looking good. We are still in the no hiring, but we're also seeing firing happening, especially among junior white-collar folk.
You're saying the big change of the last 2 or 3 years is actually the impact of AI on the hiring of young graduates.
Yes.
This is the next big fight.
It is. There's a big piece that will be coming out soon, I hope, with Harvard Business Review, where we're writing on this. And we're seeing these companies taking one of two roads, augmentation versus automation, looking for cost savings.
Augmentation is the good guys.
Yes. And automation is where companies are looking for short-term bottom-line gains through essentially reducing their headcount. And the argument I'm making is that, yes, in the short run, automation might make you a few bucks, but you're shooting yourself in the foot because workplace well-being will drop if you make people increasingly redundant. Your talent will look for the exit. You're no longer going to be an employer of choice. And your future talent pipeline is being eroded as we speak. And so that will hurt you in the next 3 to 5 years. And so the AI winners will be those that augment, not automate.
If you're an individual listening to this podcast and you're thinking, I want to be happier, what's your message to them?
There's a lot there. There are predispositions. So some people do see the glass half full rather than half empty. A bit like, and I guess you and I fall in that category.
I'm a half full man. Always have been. Yeah.
And I'm also a half full person. So I think we're very lucky on that front to begin with. But not everybody is. There are lessons from the science of well-being at the personal level. And so, again, I mean, think back to the World Happiness Report of last year, sharing meals. The average number of shared lunches and dinners in the UK is not even 7 out of the possible 14, 7 lunches, 7 dinners. And so try and work on the quality of your social life.
It's not just sharing with your partner, it's sharing with other people.
Yeah, it's mostly work. For example, in the workplace, there's been a general tendency in the Western world to start eating your lunches by yourself behind your screen. Can we try and get away from that?
Actually, the one thing I really miss about my life at the moment, I'm a kind of portfolio life guy. And consequently, you know, you flip from place to place. And the number of times you actually have lunch with someone is quite too little. Mm. One of my to-dos after this podcast is to make sure that I lunch with people more. So that's a message to me. But come on. So the people listening to the show, what should they be doing?
But similar to you, okay, reaching out, connecting, being grateful. These are typically the sort of...
being grateful.
Yes, this is not my area of expertise, but in positive psychology, there's a lot of interesting evidence around expressing gratitude, even gratitude letters, thinking positively, ending the day with thinking through the good things that happened today. These are sort of little cognitive tricks, but the honest truth is, and maybe we can end on this, is all of this is positive psychology, personal well-being. The biggest, frankly and honestly, the biggest changes to our well-being as an individual, but especially as a larger population, will come through policy. People, I hope if policymakers or senior leaders are listening, you can have so much impact on people's lives. And it's clever policy, whether it's around social media and putting guardrails in place to try and get to an optimal level of social media use, whether it's about improving jobs so that they're qualitative and not just short term.
More augmentation, less automation.
More augmentation. And there, I'm afraid, policy will have to play a role because the incentives are such for companies that they are gravitating in some kind of pool, a gravitational pull towards automation rather than augmentation. So I fear that a policy will have to step in at some point, and I think this will become a big issue in the next general election or in the run-up to it eventually, especially when we're going to start seeing the unemployment figures tick up for certain parts of the population. We study population well-being, to be honest, and so we're looking for big trends and big moves that policymakers can influence.
Any last message before we sign off?
Measure what you treasure. So we have to keep measuring well-being in workplaces, in policy. The ONS has to continue doing what it's, the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, has to keep doing what it's doing. And we need to keep reporting on it. Because if, like we do in the World Happiness Report, we have to make sure that people understand that we can measure what a good life is and that we keep promoting it as a result.
Well, Professor Nevis, thank you so much. Measure what you treasure. you come up with some great lines. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.